In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Mike and I talked to a single founder who launched a seven-figure SaaS app with special guest Nate Grahek. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 216. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. So where this week, Mike?
Well, I have been to the gym 15 times in the last 18 days.
Congratulations.
I actually don't feel all that bad. It's just like there's certain muscle groups that I didn't know that I had.
Did it get easier after the first few days?
Well, the first week was the worst. And then since then, things have gotten significantly better. It's not nearly as bad as it was the first week. I mean, the first week was really rough. And even my wife said it was like I was only 3 days in. She's just like, I don't think he's going to make it.
So MicroConf Vegas 2015, it looks like we finally have dates. And so it looks to be April 13th and 14th in Las Vegas. And of course, we always have the evening reception on the 12th. So that's really a Sunday night, Monday, Tuesday. We have signed a contract and sent it in. We haven't received the countersigned contract yet, but my guess is by the time this episode goes live that we will. So if you're interested in hanging out with about 200 self-funded startup founders, single founders, head over to microconf.com, enter your email address there, and we will be selling tickets in the next few weeks. Myself and Heaton Shaw are confirmed as speakers, and we are we have basically a full list of all the speakers we're going to be inviting. We just have not emailed everyone yet.
On episode 214, where we discussed Inbox Zero a little bit, Jack Jones left a comment on the blog, and he said, "For Inbox Zero, I highly recommend Follow Up Then. I tried Boomerang and others, but Follow Up Then works completely via email, no separate app or plugin to use. This means you can use it from wherever you deal with your email. Has lots of cool features like scheduling tasks, automatically following up with other people, and automatic cancellation when someone replies. Between Follow Up Then and emailing tasks to Trello, I've maintained daily Inbox Zero across three businesses and my personal life coming up on a year now." Thanks for that, Jack. And Tyler also said the two tools that have helped me maintain Inbox Zero for quite a while are Boomerang and To-Do, and it's T-E-U-X-D-E-U-X. Boomerang's perfect for getting emails out of your inbox when you want to deal with them later, while the simplicity and automatic task rollovers of To-Do have made it my top To-Do and calendar app.
Very nice. Good tips. We also got a comment from Ben on episode 215, which was our predictions episode, in which I predicted that 5 terabyte cloud storage would be under $100 next year. And Ben said, "The 5 terabyte cloud storage for under $100 has already happened. Microsoft announced back in October that OneDrive will be unlimited cloud storage rolling out in the coming months. Both Office 365 plans of around $70 a year or $100 a year will also include unlimited storage. And while not unlimited, my OneDrive plan was bumped up to 10 terabytes for $100 back in November." So appreciate you pointing that out. So either I'm a genius with my prediction and I was ahead of my time, or I'm just misinformed about present day cloud storage offerings. I tried out Cascade Content based on your mention and basically had them write a knowledge base article based on a screencast. And this is for the Drip knowledge base, where I recorded screencasts because they're faster for me to do. But I've had requests from customers that they want to see, you know, kind of a written version of those. And so far, so good. They've done one video and turned it around in 2 or 3 days. And so I think I'm going to send them, I probably have 5 or 6 others that I'd like to get done. But what's nice is this allows me moving forward to not have to worry about writing it out myself or hiring someone. I just have someone that I can send the video to as soon as I post it. And then within a few days, get it back, kind of like getting a transcript done or something.
Awesome.
So today, Mike and I have the distinct pleasure of having a special guest, Nate Grahek, on the show. And Nate is a single founder who launched a 7-figure SaaS app. He's also a Lifetime Academy member. So welcome to the show, Nate.
Thank you so much for having me, guys. I'm kind of a little starstruck, to be honest. It's fun to listen to you guys each week and to actually be on the show. It's definitely an honor. Thanks for having me.
Very cool. Well, do you want to start by telling folks briefly, you know, who you are, what you do?
For sure. I founded in 2012. I started a company called StickyAlbums.com. It's a service for portrait photographers to create custom mobile apps for each of their clients. So a wedding photographer, an infant photographer, high school seniors, they deliver a subset, like a very simple image gallery as a mobile app. and it becomes a marketing tool for the photographer. That's the big problem we solve, is we help photographers get more customers.
Very cool. And is your background in development? Are you a designer?
My background was in training and development and like corporate training. And very quickly, I had to learn how to do web development because all training with the economy around that time was moving to the web. We couldn't afford to fly people in for corporate stuff anymore. And so I learned HTML. I learned Flash. At the same time, iPads were blowing up. And my boss says, Nate, we got to put all training on iPads. So in the course of figuring out how to put other content on iPads and iPhones and other mobile devices with HTML, I was also doing portrait photography on the side and kind of had that classic light bulb moment of like scratch my own itch. How can I make my portrait clients better at referring me new business?
Very cool.
And I asked the client, like one of my high school senior clients, is like, because I was giving them like paper business cards to pass out to their friends. And she's like, yeah, we don't like really carrying paper. What if I give you your own custom app with your face on the icon and you can just share that with your friends? They're like, oh, yeah, I don't go anywhere without my phone. So that was the crux of the idea right there.
Got it. And so you were a photographer?
Yes. I've learned a lot about what it means to be a professional photographer now. I've very much humbled. The range is huge.
Sure.
Like, so the market's huge, but the range is also pretty big. And I was definitely considering myself a rookie on that scale. The domain experience really, really was valuable.
So you've started stickyalbums.com in, was that 2011 or 2012?
2012. I launched the site and the domain like late 11. And then had my first sale, like right in January of 2012.
Got it. And so today, towards the end of 2014, where does your business stand in terms of revenue, you know, whatever you're willing to share, and team size, if any? I'm not sure if you have full-time employees or contractors.
Got a lot of competition, so I'm trying to decide what I should share with them. That they just flooded the market kind of after I proved this idea.
Oh, geez.
And the competition's been healthy, but it's all good. So okay. Within the first 2 years, we grew to 5,000 photographers, which is roughly, everybody can do the math, it's roughly $1 million in revenue, annual revenue. That was a blur. To grow that quickly was pretty intense. And now the last year, so our third year of business, we've kind of plateaued a little bit because of the annual recurring thing where we have people that are no longer photographers that were, and we're still replacing them with new photographers at a pretty good clip. And then since this year, I really sat on the decision of growing the team for a while because I really is huge fans of your guys' podcast and like the idea of staying small and flexible and manageable. But I knew that I wanted to grow something for photographers that was going to be around in the next 5 years. And in order to do that, I wasn't going to be able to do it myself anymore. And so this year, I invested a lot of energy in growing the team. We now have 4 full-time employees, including me. We're hiring our fifth next in January. We're hiring a full-time designer I'm pretty stoked about. And then we have 4 other part-time employees that are contractors. So that growth was exciting. It's daunting to like switch gears into being a manager now. A lot of my time goes to managing, but it's really rewarding to create a remote culture where people can come to work when and how they want to. I get the unique personalities from everybody adding to a much greater sum. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun. I know that feeling too, you know, having gone from kind of doing everything on my own to then expanding, and it's good to have a team.
Yeah, it is. It's daunting. I've got 2 small kids. I knew the risk involved of growing. Being a manager always takes more time than you think it does. There's a human element you never plan for. Despite all of that added complexity, it's incredibly rewarding. Like I got to give people holiday bonuses this year, and that felt really good.
So one of the things that you mentioned kind of early on was that you were talking to somebody about how you wanted to give them a business card and they just said, oh, we don't really like paper.
Yeah.
And you kind of went down the road of saying, well, I could put your face on an app. I mean, what sort of validation did you do for this idea, or did you just kind of dive right in?
Well, it was first with like the scratch my own itch model where I just made these. Technically, I know I've got a lot of developers on the call. It's an HTML5 web app. So we've built using some open source and some proprietary tools. We prompt the user to save the web app to the home screen, and we pre-populate it with a home screen icon. But it is just a website that saves offline. And so there's huge advantages to it being that way, where it's shared with just a link instead of it being an actual native app. There had been other vendors in this space that have tried that model and failed because it's too complex to try to submit that many apps to the app store. And the photographer has to have their own developer license and on and on and on. there's just a lot of complexity there that we shortcutted by making it HTML. And it's something I figured out. I taught it myself, and I was just making these sites for my own personal photography clients and gave them to the client, and they loved them, and it brought me new business, and so much new business that I stopped sharing them in my own business because I knew I wanted to grow sticky albums, not my photography business. So I had to stop using my own product because it was working too well.
Got it. So this is really just, it's not even an app itself, but to the user, it looks like an app. But really, it's just like a shortcut to a website on their phone, right?
Exactly. I can do a link, or I'll give you guys a URL you can post in the show notes, and people can see an example of what one looks like.
Very cool. And your pricing, it's $19 a month, $29 a month, and then you have kind of a lifetime, it looks like, that's $699.
That's actually going away. The pricing page is kind of tricky. We could spend time there if we wanted, but it's...
It's $19 a month if it's billed annually, $29 right. a month if it's billed monthly. Got it. I miss that.
Like 95% of our customers on the annual membership.
Okay.
And we just find that works a lot better where people commit. Because it's a marketing tool, we've learned that people who do the monthly are just experimenting and they don't take it seriously enough. And if they don't see the results right away in that first month, then they don't renew that. Whereas when they bite off for the whole year, we have that whole year to engage with them and to teach them how to use the product, and they get to see results, and then they're a customer for the long haul.
Do you find that the sales effort up front is a lot harder because you're essentially trying to get, you know, a couple $100 all at once up front rather than...
I think it doesn't necessarily make it harder. I've learned that using a discount code, a lot of people do sign up with a discount, and it's just that like deadline, like it's a limited time offer. And we do a lot of partner deals. So one way or another, people need a reason to buy today. That's the thing we found. And beyond that, it doesn't matter if it's annual or monthly.
Right. And when you said it's going away, did you mean the lifetime membership?
Yeah. We're removing that. That was like an early on, helped us grow big and reward some of our most loyal customers. But we're going to take that away and bring in like a two-year plan.
Nice. So you'll have a monthly, annual, and two-year. So you mentioned earlier that you grew to 5,000 paying users in your first year. And obviously that's 5,000 photographers who found you, who decided to buy. A lot of folks listening to this podcast are probably wondering, how did you achieve such enviable growth? Was there one tactic? Was it a combination of tactics? What was it that gave you that hockey stick?
It was 5,000 by 2 years. So I think at the first year I was at about 3. And then the second year we made it to 5. It's not just one. I think the one that enabled the crazy speed was word of mouth. It was that I did a couple things really well. I treated my customers well. And then it's that word of mouth referral where we had a tracking form when people first came in that says, where'd you hear about us? And like I would celebrate once a week or once a month, somebody would write everywhere. It's like, oh my gosh, that's so cool. Like they were hearing about it from their friends, from other places, from other blogs. So it was definitely a combined approach. But I think more than anything, people buy when something's been referred to by somebody else that they trust.
Right. It's a lot easier sales process if someone's already been referred rather than seeing a cold ad and then having it familiar.
I have a theory like that I teach my... Like we do a lot of education now too, and teaching other photographers how to do marketing themselves. And I tell them that like paid advertising, I think the only time paid advertising works is when you already have a foundation of word of mouth referrals happening. Somebody's like, oh yeah, I heard about this cool photographer, blah, blah, blah. And Julie said she was great. And then later on that week, you see an ad in a local newspaper like, oh yeah, that's right. I wanted to call Julie, but if you just saw that ad for Julie and nobody had told you who she was, that ad's not going to really do anything.
Right.
And we found that to be true in our business too, where our paid advertising only is like icing on the cake when we have that good word of mouth buzz happening first.
So obviously once you had 1,000 or 2,000 people using it, then word of mouth is going to help. But how did you get those first few hundred users?
I got really lucky with this was even when it was first concierge. We didn't even go to the actual builder code that was written. That is the base of the business today. I went to market without that. I went to market where I was selling this as if when photographers were uploading their pictures, like a machine was doing it, but it was actually just me. I was taking people's pictures and building these one-off albums one at a time. I had a friend help me build some automation so I could be faster for myself on my local computer. I used to take like 10, 15 minutes to build each one. And then now with the app he made for me, he made this small version of an app that took it down to 5 minutes per album. And that let me just go to market. And I did a couple, I did a blog post, like a paid blog post review. And that got us like our first 15 to 20 customers. But then there was a site called Photodough, and they are like a Groupon for our industry, their meteoric rise also. And so doing a deal there was perfect because everybody knows Groupon. Like I didn't have to pay to be there. They just got a cut. The timing was right. For that first 3 days, we did $10,000 in revenue. And ironically, I had at the same time been shopping for developers. I'd met with three different developers, and they had all estimated like the MVP was going to be about 10 grand. And so my wife was pretty excited. It was a fun, exciting day to refresh that webpage and just watch the sales go up. And she's like, oh, wow, when do we get some of that? I was like, actually, now that we have 200 customers, I have to get this thing automated ASAP. And luckily, the team was able to build it in 30 days because in that month, I had, I think I built 400 websites by hand until the automated builder was done. And since then, we've made close to 1 million, I think. Apps. Wow.
Yeah, that's really impressive. So you definitely pulled the MVP approach, kind of lean startup approach of just getting out there and selling something, seeing if it caught fire. And with you, it obviously did. And then you had to use human automation to get you through it. And
yeah, it was terrifying. I risked $300 of my own money.
Yeah.
And after that, it was building with the customer money. And I was definitely nervous. I said to myself, if this fails, I will just give people their money back and apologize profusely. But I wasn't ready with a mortgage, and we just had our second kid. He was a month old. I wasn't ready to risk $10,000 of my own money yet. I wouldn't recommend anybody do something like that at that stage of their life. The lean startup stuff was, I wasn't even familiar with what I was doing. It was called lean startup until I found podcasts like you guys. It's like, oh, there's a name for what my wife forced me to do. Yeah. She's like, there's no way you're spending that kind of money. Figure it out, like how you're going to do it without it. And that's what I did.
Very cool.
So it sounds like there wasn't very much time between the time you had the idea and you realized that this really had legs. I'm curious to know kind of what your mentality was going into it, thinking that you were going to do all of this stuff by hand versus automating it first. Because I think that's a common situation where people run into something and they have this idea and they say, oh, well, I'll build some code, because naturally, you know, most of the people listening to this are developers, and that's what they do. So their first instinct is to write code to solve the problem. And you clearly went in a different direction. And that's one of the things that, you know, Lean Startup kind of advocates is, you know, testing the idea to make sure that it has legs before you do a lot of investment. And I'm curious to know what your mentality around that was. Or was it just my wife said so?
Yeah, right. I think the first idea was sitting around the fire, like it was October of 2011, with my neighbor who was a developer, saying, I knew education, right? So I was going to sell a product. I was like, there's this huge market to sell informational products to photographers. I'm going to sell videos, because that's what I did in my day job, teaching people how to make these HTML apps. Thank goodness for one of my good friends now. He's like, dude, there's such a small subset of people that will actually take the time. Photographers don't want to deal with HTML. You just got to build a builder for them. And it's not that hard. I was like, wow, really? So that's the idea. And then four months it took to flush it out. And I put my energy into the marketing site so that I could validate the idea with sales. That was where I put all of my energy, and then was just going to continue being the builder, was just the concierge, like human labor, a model first to test it. But I quickly learned there was a lot of things that I thought I would have to build from scratch. I built on WordPress, and then I bought a membership plugin. So I thought I was going to have to hire developers to build all of the membership stuff too, but that was already just like $100. I think use S2 member plugin for $100, and it let me go to market with PayPal integration like right away. Within 2 months, I was able to put up a sales page, and that was, I knew sales was the first thing I had to show before I was going to invest more money.
That's really cool that was your intuition, because obviously with most people, developers, designers, or otherwise, the typical inclination is to build something first and to go into your basement and build it. But you obviously wanted to get sales first. Where did that come from? Why was that your number one before you built anything?
I had the idea, right? I had built, it had worked for me already in my business. In other photographers, I had shared the quote-unquote product. Like they saw the finished albums that I was making. like that was it. That was the MVP there. I can sell making these for photographers. So flushing that out, that was actually the first thing. So like that was just with my own, I was just getting creative in my own photography business. Like, oh, what could I make for these, for my customers in photography? Oh, this is cool. Oh, wait, this might be a huge market for other photographers, not just my own business. And that's when I made this switch from making something for my own photography business to being a service for other photographers. That's where most of the energy went into building a sales page, because I had already put in the work building the quote unquote product. I put probably 3-4 months into researching like what the format was, to what different tools we were going to use in the JavaScript and the HTML format of the album. So there was definitely some time there. Luckily, I think I switched gears off of the product. I had dreams about making it amazing, but luckily I got my first developers that I hired. They were really big 37 Signals fans, and they were good at coaching me to keep the MVP actually an MVP.
And, you know, you had kind of a Cinderella story early on. I mean, it's kind of a rare idea that gets this much traction this quickly. I'm curious, you know, you had to have run into some hurdles, some roadblocks within that first year. Does one come to mind that really made you pause and think like, yeah, you know, maybe this won't work? Or maybe even if you don't have one that made you think that, maybe there was kind of a darkest hour time?
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge were personal, to be honest, was like the fact that I had 2 children. And like my wife was like, "Are you serious? Now is when you want to launch a business? We have a 2-year-old and an infant." So deciding when to quit the day job was very daunting. There was so much going on because I was still working the day job those first 4 or 5 months. I mean, coming home till 2 in the morning working on building these for people. So that was very, very taxing to work a 40-hour day job and then come home and put another 40 hours a week into launching it. That was not sustainable. I burned bridges with friends and family in those first months so that I could make the leap and quit the day job. And then once I was able to quit the day job, then the challenges after that was staying focused on sales. Sometimes I'll share like my revenue chart. I would have a record month, and then the next month would be like half the size. And then I would have a record month in sales, and then the next month would be half the size. And it repeated this pattern because I was doing support also. And as soon as I was able to hire a good support rep, that's when we had consistent growth, because I could stay focused on sales and marketing and partnerships, and she could stay focused on engaging the customer. As soon as I would pull away, and it was good. I I'm glad I did that. It was good for me to stay super close to the customer and know their issues and really understand that what problems I was solving and which ones I wasn't. It was instantaneous. That's the point I wanted to make, is as soon as I took my hand off of sales, I could see it impacted in the numbers right away. Like as soon as I stopped selling and marketing and building relationships with other people, sales would drop off. And that's a constant to today. As soon as I try to slow down and focus on something else, sales slow down too.
So it sounds to me like you're constantly kind of pushing down on that pedal to make sales and marketing work for you. But aside from the word of mouth, what's your most successful marketing channel that you've kind of stumbled on or identified so far?
Yeah, absolutely. As I transition into this, like the marketing piece, it's also been tempered with learning over time that there's always more features to build. Like I love building new features, and all of the features, or the majority of features we've put in, have been come from customer requests. That's never ending. Like I could fast forward 5 years and there's always going to be more to build. And my goal has been to make sure that we have the ability to build features. Like we still have a business to build features for. And I've luckily focused on sales to make sure that we keep the lights on, I think, is what's important. There's a lot of other competition in our space that's come in the space and price really cheap, and they come in and they fizzle. This is one story I like to share. It's a very humbling call. So this was an early challenge where when you first launch a product, there's this like terror. I would wake up every morning like somebody else has my idea. Somebody's going to rip this off and steal it. And that was pretty constant challenge. And then after 6 months, we had one. It would really stress me out at first. And it took me a while to really get over that, the early, like stop being worried, so focus on the competition, just focus on your own business and our own customer base. And I finally got better at that. There was this one vendor that I stumbled across. I think he was in month 2 or 3. And I was like it ruined my day. I was so sad. Like, they had so many more features. They had the HTML side. They had the app side, the native side. Their marketing video was really well done, better than what I thought ours was. And the moral of the story is, fast forward 3 years, I actually got an email from this company saying, "Hey, Nate, we love your marketing. We follow what you're doing. We're actually looking to sell and wondering if you're interested." And I had the whole conversation, really like wanted to understand what worked, what didn't, if there was opportunity for me to buy them. They had 10 customers the last 3 years. While they had built this amazingly robust, feature-rich solution, they hadn't put any energy around marketing it and educating people about how to use it in their business. They wanted to recoup some of their money that they had invested in like contracted development. I felt terrible. Like, I just felt, I really empathize with these guys, but it's one of those classic cases where they focus too much on building one more feature with their own dollars instead of building it with the company. And that comes from like my commitment to my customers. Like, I want to be around here in 5 years so that we still have a service to provide. And I do that by making sure we're growing a healthy company.
Right. And their story is the more common path, right? That's the more common story we hear of people launching a startup, is that they err on the side of too much product rather than too much sales.
Yeah. It's so counterintuitive. Like, I was really like, I was like, "Oh, we're done." Like, it's one of those things where like I found it on a Google search, or somebody said, "Hey, Nate, have you seen this company?" And I was like, "Oh, wow, that was fun. We're done."
Yep.
Like, I really thought that
they're
like,
going to put you out of business. Yeah. That's actually really common in terms of competition coming up. You always think they know more than they do. And especially if you've been in a market for any length of time and you're good at it, you typically are way, way ahead of them in terms of revenue, a customer count, and in terms of your intimate knowledge of the market.
Right. There was an analogy I made early on that I had to relearn my mindset of what the internet is. Before launching my own online business, a lot of the things I consumed online were trending things. Every once in a while, something trending comes up. Like, oh yeah, and it feels like we all know about the trending things that are happening. Like, we all know about Uber. And instead, what I've learned is the internet is like a big room, really, really, really big room. And you can yell about something for years, and the majority of the internet still won't hear you. And that is what took me some time to realize, is that it's all about getting other people to talk about you and getting your message out, because people don't need to hear about you just once. They need to hear about you over and over again. And just because you're yelling in your corner doesn't mean anybody's hearing you yet.
All right. Wise words. So, Nate, back in 2012, it was May of 2012, I did my first Mixergy interview sometime around there, and you emailed me afterwards, and you said that you saw that I had the Micropreneur Academy, and you asked me a few questions about it. And we had a short email exchange that I hadn't remembered, you know, when you and I reconnected later. And then in June of 2013, so that's about a year later, I did a Growth Hacker TV interview, and you sent me this email. You said, "Hi, Rob, I just watched your interview on Growth Hacker TV. Great stuff. It's been just over a year since I emailed you and then joined the Micropreneur Academy. While I feel I was so busy executing that I was only able to implement about 10% of the full course content, the little that I did implement was invaluable. The majority of my customers are on annual plans, and with the first few months of renewals being decent, May was my first $100,000 month." So you said, you know, thanks, and you felt a lot of gratitude, both to myself and Mike for the podcast, and then others who were so willing to share what we've learned. That was cool. I love like that, hearing that kind of story, because you kind of came out of nowhere. I was just like, whoa, who is this guy having so much success, you know? And I'm curious if you recall any specific times where you may have used either advice from the podcast or from the academy or stuff that Mike and I shared, you know, that helped you out as you were growing.
I think I heard you talk about the point of just execution early on, how important executing is. And that when I started in the academy, I think I downloaded all of the MP3 courses right away and just listened to them on like fast mode whenever I was commuting. And the one that sticks out for me, I think you did a class on joint ventures or marketing partnerships. And I think that's one that's just been probably, when you asked earlier, my most successful marketing tactic, it's just been, it's relationships, building relationships with other people. Like, marketing 101 is finding a reason for other people to talk about you and what your service is. And so some of that was easier. It was a brand new product. And think about like a blogger, somebody whose job is to educate and share good ideas to their audience. they love having something brand new and shiny to show off and talk about. So getting my foot in the door was relatively easy earlier, but now it's had to transition to building the partnership based on the audience that we now have. We can kind of swap back and forth, and then also focusing just on really good content, just really educating people. And I also learned the value of education, obviously, through Micropreneur Academy. It was just invaluable.
Very cool.
There's a couple podcast episodes that I find myself forwarding to other early stage entrepreneurs a lot. The first two are the product test and the founder test. It really helped, the founder test especially, helped me look at my own blind spots or my own opportunities for growth and not feel so bad about it. And it, through growing the team, it helped me identify key personalities I had to hire for. And one of the best lessons I've learned, I'm also was really fortunate to find a mentor in Clay Collins, who's the founder of Lead Pages. He's here in the Twin Cities. He told me the best lesson in hiring is you want to hire early in your business people who are good at doing a thing. So like instead of like a jack of all trades, that way you don't have to stop and teach them how to blog or how to podcast or how to do webinars. If they're already doing those things somewhere else, they can come in day one and start generating revenue for you. Like my first hire was customer support. I almost hired somebody that was just like good at new photography, but didn't know how to do tech support. And luckily, the last minute, the last person to apply, she had done customer support somewhere else. That would have probably broken my business. Had I made that wrong decision? Luckily, I chose the right person who could come in day one, and she started handling most of the support tickets like right away.
Very nice.
And I've learned that lesson on both sides ever since. And then finally, the episode 141, Five Elements of Effective Thinking. You guys did that book review. I quote that on a weekly basis, I feel like. Just really focusing on doubt. And I really get worried about people who are certain about things. Like always having the guts to question and to be skeptical. It's so true that in politics and other areas, we devalue that. We feel like somebody's wishy-washy. But when I'm hiring and when I'm building partnerships, it's like a huge red flag if somebody is absolutely certain about a thing. It's like, wait a second. If you're certain, that means you probably just haven't been doing that for long enough.
Right. To see the nuance of it, right?
Exactly.
It's too black and white. Very cool. Well, thanks. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. So those were episodes 133, 134, and 141 you mentioned. I think all of them are in our little greatest hits area of our website, and we'll link them up as well. Well, thanks, Nate. We really appreciate your time coming on the show and sharing your story. I think it's been inspirational for folks listening. If someone wants to keep up with you on the internet, where would they do that?
I like wrapping this up, all of my podcasts up. I do like as a reward for people to listen to the very end. I love the feedback of what part of this interview that you was most valuable to you. And send me an email, nate@stickyalbums.com.
Awesome. Thanks again for taking the time to come on the show, Nate.
You bet. Thanks for having me, guys. It was a pleasure.
Thanks, Nate. If you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690 or email it to us at questions@startupstherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups and visit startupstherestofus.com for a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.